I think that's her.
This past summer, producer Emiko Tamagawa and I drove to Maine in search of author Ann Beattie. And there she was, trim and terrific looking in short shorts and a t-shirt, long brown blonde hair, a touch of gray, the only nod to her 62 years.
I figured it's either you or Joni Mitchell.
I'm going to get you.
She directed us to parking at the home she shares with her husband, painter Lincoln Perry. It's been 35 years since Ann Beattie was the 20-something superstar of short stories, or as the New York Times puts it, the most popular and admired writer of her generation. Her stories about post-hippie life appeared regularly in The New Yorker. Of her many novels, her first, Chilly Scenes of Winter, was made into a film ultimately titled Head Over Heels. She's compared to Cheever and Salinger, but is well aware her name isn't as familiar as it once was. Well, that may be about to change. We settled onto her couch, Anne cross-legged, to talk.
Yeah. I feel like we're having like a sleepover.
I know.
Well, love your earrings.
Well, who wouldn't love that? Because you know what your writing has meant to so many people. I mean, do you know that? As people have been saying, as these recent reviews have come out, of how you sort of defined how people were supposed to live in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, I'm aware that I certainly am aware that I have fans out there, and it means the world to any writer to know that that's true. You know, personally speaking, most days I don't think about being a writer. Most days I don't write. And it's very easy to lose track of that, too. So sometimes it's nice to be made aware of it, and other times it can almost seem like a bit too much.
Well, she's being made aware of it right now. This summer, Ann Beattie released a new novella. A collection of all of her New Yorker stories comes out this week, followed by a biography of Pat Nixon. I asked her first about the novella, Walks with Men, the story of a 20-something who falls under the spell of an older man in 1980s Manhattan.
What are you saying about guys like Neil, who give this ridiculous advice that a young girl doesn't yet know is ridiculous, like when you take a cocktail, don't take the napkin because it'll stick on the bottom. And he's telling her this as if he's, you know, telling her how to cure cancer or something. And then he, you know, mistreats her, or at least we think that he does in the end. You know, we think he disappears.
Well, I don't think it was just something of that time. All of us go out and we're trying to make the break from our parents. And yet, strangely enough, we often find people that have exactly the traits of our parents, or maybe the total opposite trait, which is not going to work either, because that also is going to be an extreme. But, you know, I was in New York in the early 80s, and I did know a lot of people who saw older men. And I'm not trying to make a prototype out of the character or anything like that. But it seems to me that, you know, whereas you wouldn't listen to this advice from your parents, you'd run screaming, and people your own age don't talk to you that way. But if it's an older guy who's telling you that, women make the mistake of thinking there is a kind of attraction, reality, even neutrality about that, and that they should listen.
Ann Beattie teaches writing now at the University of Virginia, and her love of writers shows up in her work.
You see little homages, you see literary allusions. For example, I often think of The Great Gatsby, and because I do, I actually have the characters say, although it's pretty much a throwaway, a couple of lines about The Great Gatsby. It's only a wink to the reader who thought, Beattie's sounding a little bit like Fitzgerald, and then, oh, Beattie knows she's sounding a little bit like Fitzgerald.
This is when your character is walking with her stepdad and his friend, and somehow The Great Gatsby comes up, and suddenly they're off on a sidebar about how he died. Was it in the swimming pool? I love that moment.
Well, thanks. What you hope as the writer in that moment is that the reader will conflate the two texts, that the reader will think, no, of course, this is not a rewrite of The Great Gatsby. It's not meaning to be that, but to bring that up as opposed to other things, to bring up the death in the swimming pool as opposed to other things. Well, the whole piece has been about death. So one thing clearly has a particular kind of amplitude and magnification in Gatsby. It has not exactly an ironic reverberation of that, but a kind of amused reverberation of that. Yet if the reader is interested, and if they're not, I hope the scene works in its own way, the reader will know that I'm not randomly conjuring that up at all. I want to say something about Fitzgerald's book seeming appropriate to stick with my characters.
And then there were Ann Beattie's short stories in The New Yorker. As Charles McGrath writes in The New York Times, she wrote about people who were new to fiction, post-hippies, and she had to sort through all of the stories for the new compilation.
What was it like to put those together?
very strange, let me tell you. You can well imagine that I don't sit around reading my work from the early 1970s. Of course, it's very different going back and like looking at old photographs of yourself. If you haven't looked at them for a while, you see things in them that you're startled by that you truly didn't remember.
Is there a literary version of 1980s hair? You know, is there a sort of a literary version of shoulder pads where you're saying, oh, I used to write that way, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose some of the details certainly would be the equivalent of shoulder pads, or maybe even shoulder pads per se. I know exactly what you mean. But, you know, the interest is the writerly interest. Did I just appropriate that thing as a detail because it was telling? And it's perfectly fine if you did. But is it part of some motif? Do you hope that it will have some other import? In other words, were the shoulder pads, you know, huge protection, and was this something, you know, slightly at odds with the rhetoric of feminism? I mean, all those sort of things do knock around in your mind after the fact.
Well, for those of us who are looking back at photographs of ourselves and not our writing from 1970, it is the shoulder pads we see.
I have to agree with you. I once had an author's photo in major shoulder pads, and I was so proud of them. I was so proud.
And then the book on Pat Nixon. Why Pat Nixon?
The book... is about the difficulty of knowing, and this is hardly a brainstorm of mine and mine alone. Writers cover that territory all the time. But she seemed to me somehow to be really an enigma, somebody who pretty much has been lost to time, or people haven't gone back in effect and reexamined the photographs. I have. I've got them here in the house. I have a lot of books about Richard Nixon in which she's only the footnote. So in a way, I don't want to give myself too much credit here, but some of my writing method was to do a sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, if you know what I mean.
The play?
The play by Tom Stoppard, right, in which you take the focus off of Hamlet, and then what about the two messengers? I still think that's a really exciting way to look at things. And Mrs. Nixon was the quintessential secondary person, if she was even that. But, you know, I'm looking at it sort of like an armchair psychiatrist, sort of like a woman who was younger than she at the time, who absolutely dismissed her. She would have seemed to me to be ludicrous and pointless. But at the same time, you know, she was a real person. And what did it feel like? What was her POV? She is the only one of the president's wives never to have written a book when she left the White House. We don't have it easily, what her POV is. So you have to read between the lines. You have to be able to make educated guesses. You have to look really carefully. And of course, in the majority of cases, he so subsumes everything. So yes, a very modest woman. What is that like for someone who had a life very different from what they expected, very different from what they were promised? In point of fact, he repeatedly told her he would leave politics. He repeatedly made promises to her, even if it was just a vacation that was interrupted by, you know, his having to leave the cruise ship and go back to Washington, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know, I don't solve a mystery in the book, but I think articulating that mystery, I'm hoping, isn't just something I'm saying about Pat Nixon in that time period, but something I'm saying in general about knowing other people, and something I'm saying a little bit more specifically as a woman about another woman and about those times, the 1940s, 1950s, that seem so gone in so many ways that we need not rethink them. And often, I don't know about you, but I'm brought up short. I think, God, is this like 1950 or something, this attitude I just heard? Yeah. Happens to me all the time.